Well, usually I prepare my mind for talking during the quiet lunch hour. This time I've been talking all during the lunch hour, so I apologize. It's just the way it worked. So,
set her up.
Huh?
Set you up.
Well, it's a rare meeting with Brian.
He's pretty excited when I made the suggestion.
Yeah, it was a very rare and wonderful occasion. So I'm not. I thank you. Truly, thank you. So all over the world, as I said the other night, and certainly for sure today, Soto Zen people and others are sitting Rohatsu Sesshin, celebrating the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha. And we don't know when Buddha was enlightened, what day or month or even exactly year. But we choose it. Someone chose it in the time when other celebrations of light are happening. It seems very fitting. So usually I talk about it in terms of the kind of romantic terms of the light. But I've been listening to a very interesting series of talks by Stephen Batchelor, who talks in a very sort of pragmatic and prosaic way about Buddha's experience. And I thought I would share some of that with you today. When Buddha first left home, renounced his life as a prince in a fabulous castle, he went to the greatest teachers and philosophers of his day and achieved everything that they had to offer, and still was not satisfied. So then he went off into the jungle and tried hard for 6 years to transcend the body. Really tortured himself in a way in order to get beyond this huge limitation of the flesh. And when he gave up, he was nearly dead. He'd starved himself to death. He gave up by a memory that he had of sitting in his father's garden as a boy under a rose apple tree, and having a sense of felicity. Nothing fancy. No great rockets going off or flashes of light. Just focused, concentrated, and self-aware. A state of contentment and well-being. A pleasure born of seclusion. No distraction. Nothing to want or need. and alone with oneself in self-reflection. Not trying to figure anything out. Not trying to be something else. Just actually being. Which Stephen Batchelor says the word path that is used as in the Eightfold Path, the meaning of it is being. So when Buddha awoke to the path, what he was awaking to was human being. Not the illusionary dream that we're living in. But he settled down into actually trying to see what it is that's happening. What it is that we are. How it is that we be. He grew up in a tradition, in the Brahmanic tradition. And their sense of salvation went like this. That each person has an immutable, perfect, permanent self that is divine and is a part of God, you could say. But it's caught in reincarnation because each one is blinded by his own greed and anger and delusion, that connection with the divine is hidden. And so the way to be free of the cycle of birth and death, and one just gets born and reborn over and over again as a result of how one is driven by those desires. The person can practice yogic practices of denial, self-denial, until the identity with true reality becomes aware, one becomes aware and unites with it. So that was Buddha's effort, that was Shakyamuni's effort, or Siddhartha's effort, was to labor and humiliate himself to the point where that unity would take place. When he began to sit, he began to question and try to see as clearly as he could. And what he saw was the contingency of everything. He saw that you could not pick up any even small thing without the whole rest of the universe and all the other universes coming with it. There's nothing that is separate from everything else. There is no one thing apart from all the other things that exist. And there is no one thing that can exist without being completely dependent on everything else. as we live our lives and try to figure out how to live and fit in and be as authentic as we can be, we're encouraged to be individualistic, to take care of ourselves and make our full effort. And to feel that, recognize that we're independent. Even more so in this society, I think, than in many, and in this urban environment than in the little villages out farther away. The sense of separation is very great. And the suffering that comes with it is very great. We're conditioned to believe that we're separate, and that we should be, and that we should be able to cope. And the interesting thing is that when Shakyamuni Buddha sat down all by himself, and really began to think about things. And he was not meditating in the way that we think about meditation. This is the very first stage of meditation that he started with, the first jhana. It wasn't a trance, it wasn't an exalted or even equanimous state particularly. It was a very particular way of just trying to look at things and to see how they are. He could see how totally interdependent everything is. How he himself was completely determined, you could say, embedded in life, inextricably embedded in life. And he saw what he said was the world as a kind of arising and passing away, continually arising and passing away, that there was no thing that was not going to go away. And from that going away, there was something that was going to appear. So that although everything is shifting and changing and coming and going, it all continues. We can't say there's a real beginning. You can't say there's a real ending. We say we begin, you could say. You began when your mother and father came together, when one particular sperm of millions and one egg of hundreds met. But actually they came from somewhere. You have to go farther back. Where did those come from? Well, they came from the generation before, and then they came from, and you can trace it all the way back to the Big Bang. Another insight he had was the impermanence, the passing away, or the contingent which depends on exactly which sperm and which egg, which depends on exactly when our parents came together. If they'd stayed out later and done had one more dance, we wouldn't be here. If they'd gone to bed early, we wouldn't be here. Everything comes together very, very particularly. Very mysteriously, really. We can't pull it out without pulling everything with it. So seeing things that way, when Shakyamuni Siddhartha tried to see the self, this self that he'd been striving so hard to connect with the divine, he couldn't find it. The harder you look, the harder it is to find it. At a glance, we can think about ourselves as, oh, I'm so-and-so. But if we really begin to look deeply into our life and try to find something that we can touch and name and identify as our very self, what we find is shifting and changing continually, being, but not some one fixed thing. Sometimes when we practice, people feel like we're supposed to throw our ego away. But the ego is just a made-up idea. There isn't anything to throw away. It's just one more idea. We can get stuck with that idea and cling to it. The who we are today isn't the same who as we were 20 years ago. Sometimes we try to hold on to that. I'm finding that now as I get older. I think of myself as younger than I am. And then I look in the mirror and I think, my God, where'd that old woman come from? It's very strange. And our misery comes from clinging to those old ideas, those old identities. Actually, all of our identities, our understandings come after the fact, after the reality. In the moment, we don't know. In the moment, we don't know who we are. We just are. And then self-consciousness comes and we think, how do I look? And, you know, did I wear the right thing today? And all of those things. But the truth is, we just are. So what Siddhartha saw as he continued to sit was that human life is marked by impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self, no fixed, constant, complete, permanent self, but just a constant changing self that goes on and on in one form or another, moment after moment, day after day, so that the photograph that's taken of the baby in the mama isn't the same photograph that is taken of that baby 78 years later. You would never even know they were the same. Now, there's always a big discussion about what is the same. The Soto Zen teachers are having a listserv discussion about that very thing right now, having a big argument about rebirth. Very interesting. But
they're even talking about rebirth?
Well, it came up because there's a thing called eSangha online, a website that is purported to be a Soto Zen website, and it's run by a Tibetan teacher, and he's being very he's not letting some of the Soto Zen teachers say some things. One of them tried to talk about rebirth and how in Zen we don't really talk about that very much because we don't really know. And he refused to put that in.
He's moderating it?
He's moderating it. He's really censoring.
Yeah.
He's censoring it. So some people got very hot under the collar about this, and then there started this big discussion about what do we really know? What do we really believe? Some have been very eloquent about it, but it's a big subject. And the Tibetans believe in reincarnation, and the Zens kind of agreed that they believe in rebirth, meaning as moment by moment we are reborn. That we as who we are reborn as who we are, as this ephemeral sort of transparent or translucent being, the being of us, which isn't really a self or a person in any kind of fixed way, but it continues for a certain length of time. And then we don't know after that. And are willing not to know rather than trying to create some kind of new idea about it. Because then you get into the area of belief, and then you get into the area of arguing about it. You know, once it's a belief thing, then you. So it's a very interesting subject. Buddha said that we're not doomed because we're impermanent and dissatisfied and selfless. That our very dissatisfaction is the greatest help for us. And from that, we learn to be what he called mindful. And that's the thing that he encouraged more than anything. Mindful meaning being present and being in our body. When we think of ourself, usually our idea of ourself doesn't include our body very much. We like not to think that we're a body. Bodies are messy. We never are satisfied with how they look. We always think they're imperfect, and they excrete yucky things and definitely fall apart, feel pain. Buddha said, just be your body. Know your toes. Know your breath as it comes and goes. there's a practice that they're doing in Santa Cruz now, kind of, this sounds very strange to me, a John Kabat-Zinn practice where they name the 32 parts of the body. They memorize them and then recite them over and over, recite them forward, recite them backward, becoming more and more familiar with being the whole package, rather than always putting it off over there. Oh, that's not me. To come and just live the sense of us. But of course, that's not enough to deal with greed, anger, and delusion. And so, as we know from our studies with Shantideva, there are the whole lifetime study of compassion and understanding that is our practice, that was Buddha's practice. Buddha didn't finish his sit under the tree and then go off and never sit again. He did meditation continually. He sat with the rich, he sat in cow barns with the poor. He sat with his students. He went off like an old Tusker elephant and sat all by himself. When he was dying, he went through all the different phases of meditation, from this very first one all the way up to the very most abstract and complete one, all the way back down again, and then died. So in Shikan Taza, we always talk about it as thinking about not thinking, that being non-thinking. It's a kind of mysterious way of talking about this practice of just coming to the cushion and being as we are. It includes thinking, because thinking is what we are, but it's the embodied thinking, the allowing thinking, the allowing everything to be as it is, as it wants to be. So that's what I brought. And there's time for discussion, questions.
Is Stephen Batchelor's from one of his books? Or
no, it's talks that he gave at Spirit Rock. And another set from somewhere else, I've forgotten where.
So it's actually like his Dharma talks, or his talks that he gave at
Spirit Rock? Yeah, it's a series of talks at a retreat. It's on, I think it's on his own site, on his own website. But there are Dharma Seed talks, but you just
so
looking up.
He's a practitioner, then?
Yes. And a scholar.
Yeah, it's
he translated Nagarjuna in his own kind of poetry. Very strange version of it, but a very wonderful one, too.
Huh. This Western concept of authentic self. If I can understand it as Buddha explained it, as interdependent, that the path or my being or our being is interdependent, it's impermanent, it's a mess, it's suffering. Um, there's a richness about the being, though. It's that we can all share. Maybe it's not authentic to just one person, but it is like the core. Or I think Trungpa refers to it as our basic goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And or is it the same as original face? Nature.
Mm-hmm. Buddha nature. Yes. There was, where did I see that? A beautiful little Korean poem from Korean Zen saying, we're clouds, we come from a cloud, and we float through the life as a cloud until we disappear again. And it's all coming and going. And when everything is gone, what's left? Something like that, more beautiful than that, but that, and then they say, only don't know. That's their practice, the only don't know.
The Korean, isn't it?
Yes.
Michael, this week you've been referring back in, to a poem. Now I'm not sure if it's the fifth or sixth patriarch, but it's when, to see ourselves, we go back up the river, and you go, like we're like drops of water, and you go back up the river, and you keep going up until it's a creek, and then just a little bit of a drop, you know, droplets, and then you go to the very, very end, and you stay there until clouds appear.
I don't know that poem.
It feels like the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's going all the way back to the source.
Mm-hmm.
And then really where it is, I mean, where the
cause. Yes. Yeah. Oh, thank you. I'd like to see that. I have to ask Michael.
I'm sure I've asked that before, but it just rings more and more. The path is the same as being? Is he saying as a metaphor? Or way back to the way that the word is?
I think he meant the word is that path is being. So that you don't go on a path. You live the path where you are. So you can't go off the path either.
The path, I mean, look at the way, I mean, how rich of all the great religions and great poets have used that word.
Yeah.
In terms of like the metaphors of nature and all that, I find it really hard to put it back into like a human element of how we deal with people every day. Like, how our human interactions, our mm-hmm. human dilemmas, our human confusion, how does all that fit into like the rain and the trees and all that kind of thing?
No, they're all practicing together.
But in terms of human experience, I mean, I guess art to me, like, you know, drama poetry, I mean, you know, when we're dealing with Shakespeare, when we're dealing with characters and what they're, you know, it gives us a chance to kind of see us as rain in a way, seeing these people with the same mindset that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Allows us to kind of engage and detach at the kind of
yes,
at the same time.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's how art serves us, is to create that detachment. So we see ourselves as rain, as we see rain.
Somewhat.
Yes,
like in terms of like
as
the
nature.
We feel
I understand.
Or
yes. It's weather. Yeah.
I saw, I feel like this is getting into discussion, but I saw a very interesting film, No Country for Old Men. Mm. And it's very, very violent picture, but it was dealing with, like, the problem of evil in a very interesting way that kind of made it that whole dream
mm-hmm.
thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, how we experience evil is as much weather as anything
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know, but this savagery sometimes that we notice, we get scared from, we want to be protected from.
Yes. Or get hooked by.
Yes, that, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Pema's way of talking about it is very helpful about the hooks that, I don't know whether we hook it or it hooks us. I think it works both ways. The things that seem so real to us and make our lives so miserable because we're so caught by them.
This went up a lot with greed.
Yes, a lot has to do with greed and anger. You know, that sense of anger / hatred, which is actually hatred is a better word because anger is real weather. That just comes and goes. But hatred is a poison, like greed is a poison. It can really hurt us and others.
I kind of think greed is interesting because we do need, as human beings, we do need things to survive.
Yes.
It's always the question of how much do we need.
That's the point.
Now, so it seems to be that's part of our humanity in a way to be. Maybe
yes.
There's this pull. But also there's an element of greed and evil as well.
Yep. So we get to decide how much is too much. How much house, how much sex, how much food.
Sorry. How do we...
We look around and we see, and we're living in a world where there's never enough house. There's never enough food. You know, people are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and houses are getting huge. Sexuality is this big deal. You know, what are the other ones? Sleep. You know, sleep is a big problem in our culture. Either too much or too little sleep.
Happiness and depression. So depression is the number one growing.
Yes. So it, because we have so much of everything, we have the luxury and the suffering of having to decide what's too much. Because it's all survival. We can't survive without any of it. The other desire is being known by others. And this is a society when it's all about fame. Everybody wants their 5 minutes of fame. And we'll go to great lengths to be known. And yet we all need it also. You know, it's survival to have connection, real relationship with people. So it's tricky. It's our work is to actually manufacture a life for ourselves that is reasonable.
Like, does the celebrities mix up being known and being seen?
Yes.
But I think, well, and you can be seen by the whole universe and be like depressed.
Yes.
But you are. One isn't getting what one wants.
That's right. Even if thousands of teeny boppers come and
no matter how much noise they make.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask about the being, the path and the being. I've been thinking, why does it say the Buddha, I vow to become it? I vow to become it. Don't say I vow
to be it.
Follow it and walk on it. The same thing as you become now?
Yeah, that's...
I know, because once in the future, I'm a path one already is. But I don't... I'm the tell I get rid of a lot of junk. I'm not really who I am anyway. I mean, it's hidden under things I believe, so it will be hidden.
Well, that's the Brahmanic view, that your real self is hidden somewhere, hidden underneath all the limitations of you know, greed and anger. And Buddha didn't say that. He didn't say your real self is hidden. What you see is what you get. It's just how we see.
It's a what theory? Brahmanic, referring to
the Hindu
oh,
view. So in terms of Buddha's teaching, it's, and this is Zen, I mean, if when I think of the other traditions, they all have a slightly different view, but from the Zen point of view, all beings are Buddha nature itself.
It's so difficult to say nothing extra.
Mm-hmm.
And the more extra there is, I've been thinking that the more extra there is, the more hidden, the more obscure the essence is.
I don't think you can see your own essence. I think that's where we get caught, because we're always trying to figure out who we are and what that is. And I don't think we can. We just mislead ourselves and make some kind of idea about it and then try to live up to it. My doctor said to me the other day, perfection is living up to your complete potential in each moment. And so wherever you happen to be is a perfect place. And you can't judge it yourself. You can't tell. You're just being as you're wherever you are, even if you're being an idiot. You're being a Buddha idiot, you know. It's really okay. There's no other place to be, or no other one to be. There can't be, because that isn't how it works. If you really look at it, you can't be any, you can't pull some part of yourself off and put it over here in a can and make it go away.
Or label it as essence.
Or label it as essence. Where would it be? It's just, this is what it is.
It's one thing for you to say that. It's another thing if it's one of the names. Let's see. At any moment, just any name.
Low
high. Yes, comes and sits next to you.
Yeah.
It's right there, tries to irritate the position.
Who is this?
Lindsay Lohan.
Who is that?
Paris Hilton.
Oh, Paris Hilton?
Yes.
Oh.
The whole lineup. It just seems to me that one essence is. A little clearer than some of the others. I don't really want to argue. I just want to get it.
who has created who?
Don't you think that if I go down and get liposuction, my eyebrows dyed, my lips dyed, also my nose altered, my tongue pierced,
That's all tapas practice. That's all what Buddha did before he sat down under the tree. Trying to transcend the body. So it's what many human beings try to do until they finally get to the point where they realize that they're killing themselves.
Oh, so either way, total deprivation or total tattooing from head to toe is the same story.
It's the same effort.
Oh, that's a new idea.
Yes.
So, you know, we try to support people where they are and try to see them where they are without judgment. Now, everyone is practicing.
Everyone is?
Is practicing. Everyone is trying their best. Including the kid who shot people in the mall. Including the guy who killed the girl in the parking lot in Willits. You know, I know. I think we're just very undeveloped, primitive creatures with some ability to see more clearly sometimes. And when we do, we begin to connect with everyone else and see how we're all trying the best we can. And then we can forgive ourselves for not doing as well as we might, because we're just human too. Because we don't do so well a lot of the time. We just don't. But that's Buddha being Buddha also. That's what we've got. Wendy?
Okay, I'll get in on this little debate. Everyone's trying doing the best they can. It seems to me there's a lot of denial and avoidance going on in this culture.
There is.
You know, people that really aren't being fully being. There's, a lot of excesses. And then, there's people that are trying to bury their head in the sand and not look at anything, or taking, self-medicating so they don't have to look. But this is their way of being.
It's the best they can do. And the more we're able to see and to see through what's going on, the more we're able to open things up for ourselves and make space for being of some help. That as long as we're in a judgmental state of mind, we can't really see who's there. And then once we can see, then we're not stuck behind a fence. No, we can come out when we need to and lend a hand. No, we don't need to all the time, but we can be available. But if we just see things from a superficial view, everything is a mess. I mean, everybody is a mess of one kind or another. If you knock on anybody's door, you find a soap opera and a denial and lying, and, you know, all the precepts are broken. We all break them all the time. So it's not a matter of being perfect in that way. It's a matter of how we, what kind of mind we bring to what we see. A compassionate mind, a vigorous mind, you know, to be really strong enough to be able to embrace what we see without rejecting it. Doesn't mean we have to like it.
Well, you know, it's usually people you're connected to.
Yeah.
So you just, I always have the impulse to comment on what I see.
Well, you have a very sharp mind.
Completely be mistaken for being judgmental.
Mm.
I'm learning how to share my observations without putting myself on the pedestal.
Yeah. They're the Buddhas. And you don't. I always think it's, from a Buddha point of view, it's easy to love people, but not necessarily to like them. And that we don't have to like everyone, but we can love them all.
I think I once heard you say that Buddhists don't use that word very much. Zen Buddhists don't use that word very much.
No, they don't. They put compassion in there. But,
so when you say it right then, it's interchangeable with compassion.
Yes. Which means feeling for and with others.
Yeah.
So we don't say, there but for the grace of God go I. You say, there I go. That's me too. I was in a situation not long ago when somebody really messed up and then apologized. And it was to a group. So he apologized to the whole group. And afterwards, several people in the group came up to me and said, wow, that was really something. But you know, I mess up in the same way too. And it was like everybody got it. You know, the apologizer. And then that made it possible for everyone to see how they make the same mistake. That we're all in this soup together. We like to think that we're, you know, kind of more separate and more pure, but we're not. Alas, we're not.
It's like inviting someone to cast the first stone.
Yeah.
And not having a stone thrown.
Yes. Yeah.
Doesn't this all come around to your question about how to, in the workplace, how you apply all this? I mean, that's how I heard your question, you know. Because for me at the workplace, this is where all this would come up. You know, here in the Sangha, you know, oh yeah, you know, life is good, and then you go to the workplace and everyone's a mess. And that's exactly what made us all the same, or brought us together.
I think there's a limitation to denial at some point. Sometimes it stretches pretty far. but setting up, you know, this is going like, I think that's why provocateurs in culture can be somewhat helpful, because they kind of
wake people up.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to treat something than some, you know, pointing to it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, sometimes I find it hard to necessarily trust what I see because, you know, I have a very active imagination. And sometimes it's kind of hard to trust that. Like, sometimes it seems easier to blame myself than to really, though I sometimes like see the situation, well, you know what, that it's probably on their end at this point. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can someone analyze, but I think it's easy. I guess it's a way of having more control.
Yes.
To if you put it on yourself.
Yes.
But it doesn't. Still doesn't work out.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. We often do that. We turn it on ourselves and come to grief that way. As if there is a self to turn it on to start with. No, we have to make up the self and then we blame the self. So there's all extra layers and layers on that.
Well, I guess
it's a dream world.
The self instance of like, well, at least I know that I could do something. I could say some words that don't amount to anything. Or in a certain situation, or, you know.
Well, right speech can make a huge difference. Because you are the situation. You are each situation that you're in. That's what you are. You're not Julian in a, you know, a platonic way, you know, a perfect image up in the sky somewhere, idea. You're just who you are right now in this situation. At work, you're whoever you are at work and how you are with people as you meet them. So you don't stay the same.
Sometimes I'm a real angel and sometimes I'm a real butthead.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And so are we all. And sometimes we have to apologize. Right? Very, very sorry. Well, it's time to sit, isn't it? This is the end of practice period. We had a sort of undeveloped practice period this time, I think, but I think some of us did some work. You did the Lotus Sutra.
Started it.
And you wrote a whole novel.
Really? 50,000 words.
Wow.
Yeah, it was National Novel Writing Month on November. So
you go.
It's quite an experience. I don't suggest everything. I don't know. I was exhausted afterwards.
And you all did some extra too, didn't you?
Seems like it.
It seemed like it. Just.
It just seems like every time I turn around, it's floating Zendo time.
Well, just putting the newsletter together was a practice.
Yeah, what's that? Study group.
It's study group. Yeah, we've been living it up to here.